Congresswoman Pelosi, are you at all concerned that the new January 6th committee will find you liable for that day? Are you at all concerned about the new January 6th committee finding you liable for that day? Why did you refuse the National Guard on January 6th?
Shut up. I did not refuse the National Guard. The president didn't send it. Why are you coming here with Republican talking points as if you're a serious journalist?
The American people want to know. We still have questions. Thank you.
Well, that was Nancy Pelosi. I don't think I've ever seen her so unhinged, but she was a little bit unhinged. Now, the interesting thing about it is, you know, that's just so rude. And even though she is kind of a mean, rude person, she's usually more controlled than that. But I want you to hear, certainly we know that Nancy Pelosi is up to her ears in guilt over the planning of January the 6th. I'm just telling you. There was a plan, and she was a big part of it. And all of that's going to come out. I think I've probably said enough about it in the past that you understand that this thing didn't just develop organically, and it wasn't all the Trump supporters that went there on that day didn't go to overturn the government. None of them were armed. They were waving flags. Some were waving crosses. They were singing. Now, there were some rogues in the crowd, no doubt about it, who were not... We're not Sunday school attenders. And so there was some violence after the police shot fire, fire bombs into the crowd. And some people actually caught on fire. It was a disaster. And that was the turning point. You've heard me talk about that before, but I wanted to mention it again. Okay, so Nancy Pelosi is upset that reporter asked her that question, what her role was on January the 6th. Why did she not... follow President Trump's request for National Guard, and she got really mad, maybe for a reason. But here's what people will hear. Fox 11 actually did a report on that, and I just want to play it for you to hear how they, bent the situation a little bit to Nancy Pelosi's advantage. Here's clip one. Let's listen.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with an unexpected outburst when a reporter for a pro-Trump media outlet would not stop bothering her.
Committee finding you liable for that day. Why did you refuse the National Guard on January 6th?
Shut up. I did not refuse the National Guard. The president didn't send it. Why are you coming here with Republican talking points as if you're a serious journalist?
The American people want to know.
Well, this happened on the steps of the U.S. Capitol today. The reporter, Allison Steinberg, works for Lindell TV, a pro-Trump media network owned by election denier Mike Lindell, the MyPillow founder.
Okay, so do you see how the media twists things? A pro-Trump reporter, pro-Trump media outlet, bothered by their costing Nancy Pelosi. Reporters ask leaders or congressional members questions on the steps of the Capitol all the time. And it's not considered. Have you ever heard a press conference with President Trump? The reporters kind of shout their questions and they get in. They ask uncomfortable questions all the time. And Nancy Pelosi knows full well that President Trump requested the National Guard. It's in writing. We know that this is true. So she lied and there it is. But Fox 11 was protecting her. Well, I want to set the stage for today's discussion, because there's one man who received a sentence on January the 6th that is just outrageous. It was 17 years. Joe Biggs is his name. He was there with the Proud Boys. Do you know what the Proud Boys are and were and still are? Actually, they're still an entity. We're going to talk about that today. We're going to find out what they were doing in the Capitol on that day. And we're also going to find out what happened to Joe Biggs. It's a really compelling story, and I'm going to ask you to help him, by the way. At the end of the show, I'm going to ask you to help him because he's lost his medical coverage. He's lost his military pension, even though he's a decorated veteran. It's really very tragic what's happened to Joe, and you're going to hear the story today and find out how you can help him. But first, you know, the headlines remind us daily, speaking of that report I just played, truth is being silenced. And when truth is silenced, lives are at risk. Imagine this. You're a single mom with two children. You have no money, no support. And then you find out you're pregnant with triplets. Well, that's a true story. It was Veltasia's reality. Alone, overwhelmed and afraid. But when she walked into a preborn network clinic, she was surrounded with love, resources, and the truth that her baby's lives mattered. Today, all three of her children are alive because truth triumphed over fear, and someone like you helped her find that truth. Preborn shines truth into the heart of mothers, deciding between the life and death of their baby. There are lots of stories like this, and I've tried to tell them to you through the time we spent together. That story is actually true. And there are other mothers just like that, maybe not with triplets, but with babies in their womb, their lives are changed because of the work of preborn. If you would like to help, $28 provides one ultrasound for one mom and saves one baby. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And you know you can call us at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can listen to the podcast on any podcast platform, Spotify or, I don't know, Amazon, whatever you use, Apple. But also, of course, our home base is American Family Radio. So you can listen at afr.net. And last but not least, if you're not used to podcasting and a little bit not sure of yourself, when you go online, go to sandyrios.com and you can listen very easily, sandyrios.com. All right, you're in for a personal story. Those are my favorites, just the story of people's lives. And our guest will be Joe Biggs, who has spent 4 years in prison. He's had his sentence commuted, but now he has no medical and no way of supporting his daughter. It's really a sad story, and we're working to make it right on Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Hello there. A court has sentenced two members of the far-right Proud Boys militia to long prison terms for storming the US Capitol building in January 2021. Joseph Biggs, you can see him there, a former leader of the Proud Boys, was given 17 years, one of the longest sentences among the hundreds convicted for the Capitol attack. Prosecutors say Biggs was a key figure in the organized attempts to forcibly overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. Another leader, Zachary Rell, was given 15 years.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. I think actually we interviewed Zachary Rell a long time ago before he got sentenced. But I haven't really spent a lot of time with any of the Proud Boys. And that's the one deficit on what happened at J6 that I have failed to cover. No, not for any particular reason, but I want to correct that today. Now, Joe Biggs was sentenced to 17 years. His sentence was commuted. He was not pardoned. I think he served 4 years. And so Joe is an Iraqi war veteran. He was injured, got a Purple Heart for his valor, had a brain injury and PTSD. And when he was convicted, his pension and all of his benefits, medical and otherwise, were removed from him. And so he is in a really tough spot. And I'm going to be asking all of you, actually, when we finish this conversation, I'm going to ask you to help him. So I just want to prepare you for that. But first of all, I want to welcome Joe. We're going to have a nice, long conversation. Joe Biggs, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Joe, where did you grow up?
Kind of all over the place. My mom was a teacher, so I grew up on the Clemson University campus, the University of South Carolina. So a lot of the Carolinas back and forth. I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
And then some friends of mine that were there, that lived there, moved to Florida, and I followed them. They were my best friends, and it was just me and my mom. So we moved down to Florida eventually when I was you know, a teenager, and I've been in Florida pretty much ever since.
Good choice. That's where I live too, Joe. We came down here from D.C. We fled down here from D.C. some time ago. So, all right, so what were you doing before you joined the Army? I mean, what was the thing that you did, the thing you wanted to do? What were you doing?
Well, I was homeschooled. I played golf. I was a surfer, and I sang in bands, and I was a DJ. So I used to DJ in Siesta Key Beach, Florida, for work at different places. And then I spent a lot of time in the ocean surfing, going to Costa Rica, Australia, traveling around.
Okay, so that
I didn't join the Army until I was about like 19 years old, 20. So, I mean, I was still pretty young.
Well, yeah, that is young. And I'm, you know, I guess I'm thinking, now a surfer and a singer, by the way, I'm a musician and a singer. A musician who likes to surf and do what you were doing is not a likely candidate to join the American military during wartime. So what motivated you to do that?
Well, my best friend that I call my brother, he joined the Marines, and he got shot in Iraq. And it pissed me off. So I was like, you know what, I got to get off my butt, and I can't sit here and watch this unfold on TV anymore. And I was watching the news, and they were saying that recruitment was down. You know, people were scared. They didn't want to go over there. That it was a lost war. It was pointless. And I just kind of, you know, my mom said one day, she's like, you can't be a DJ forever. Why don't you do something? I was like, you know what? When you come home from work, I'll have a job. And I went straight to the recruiting station. And when she came home, she was shocked to find out that I was about to quickly leave and go to basic training. And then 4 months later, I would be at my first base, which was Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and then soon thereafter, off to Iraq.
Well, just a question about your mom. Now, she's a teacher, so I'm making assumptions. If she was teaching at colleges, I'm thinking, you know, not many conservatives teach at college campuses. So was your mother a political conservative, or was this a sort of this patriotism, a kind of an aberration in your family?
Everybody in my family is, everybody's conservative. There are no differences in politics or anything like that. We're all a very Christian, conservative family. We've always been. My mom's father was in the Air Force. My dad was in the Marine Corps. So, you know, it was a natural thing. I mean, you know, she's one of those people that she's slowly told me over time that she's seen the curriculum in colleges change from the truth to lies. And, you know, she's retired now from it, but she said she saw the books coming in and they would be changing her history right there in front of her. And each year a new book would come out and there would be something slightly changed or modified. And then over the years, it would just be from the truth to a complete and outright lie. You know, colleges are not a place for higher education. They're a place for indoctrination. And that's why I refuse to, you know, spend any money in a place like that, you know, as I got older.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, the Weather Underground, are you familiar with who they are?
Yes.
Yes. So Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, I'm from Chicago, so I used to cover this on the radio a lot. I actually came a hair's breadth from interviewing Bill Ayers, but he backed out on me. But Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, of course, were the heads of the Weather Underground. They were terrorists, the terrorists of their time, who wanted a radical, revolutionary, radical, violent overthrow of the United States government. And they ended up, like the other radicals with them, teachers in universities. And, of course, Bill Ayers wrote Curriculum, which is the reason I'm bringing him up. And so you're totally right, and it was intentional. It was very successful. So you go to Fort Bragg.
Was it Chester Boudin, and then you got Saul Alinsky?
Yes. Yes, all those. Yes, all of that. So you know all about that. And that's kind of my bailiwick too, Joe, the left and tracking it. But Fort Bragg, North Carolina. When I think of Fort Bragg, I think of my good friend, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, who was the founder of Delta Force. That was his home base. But you went to Fort Bragg for training, and what did you end up doing? What was your assignment?
So I went in, when I initially joined, I went in as an artilleryman. because I just, you know, I actually scored high on my ASVAB and my GT and all that. But I just asked them, I said, what do you need? And that was a stupid thing on my part. So they go, hey, we need artillery. But then we get to Iraq and they go, yeah, we're not doing artillery anymore. We're kind of phasing that out because it's just pointless. But what we do need are people to do convoys and convoy security. So basically from the get-go, I did, you know, basically like infantry stuff. We would do mounted patrols. We would escort EOD, which is the explosive ordnance disposal. So when guys would go out and, you know, get hit with an IED, they'd have to come in and do tactical site exploitations. They'd have to come in and disarm a bomb or something like that. We would provide security for them. And then that slowly morphed into providing security for all the fuel that would be brought into Iraq throughout the war. So we did convoy security for KBR fuel trucks. And all you did was drive around and get blown up and go to funerals all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
I spent 2 years in Iraq, and I spent 2 years in Afghanistan as well.
Okay. Such a dangerous job, really. I mean, I do understand. It's so dangerous and stressful. And do you think anything positive came from that in your own life?
Of course. I mean, you learn the art of selflessness. You know, you have to learn to put your brother to your left and right, regardless of color, religion, their well-being ahead of your own. You learn teamwork. You learn perseverance. You learn, you know, tact, patience, integrity. I mean, there's all kinds of things that a young man at that age that I was needed to learn. I didn't have a father that was around much. So, you know, actually just found out that he died about a month ago and I didn't even know where he lived. So,
wow.
You know, it's been pretty much me and my mom my entire life, and I didn't have a father figure. So, you know, the Army was, you know, who stepped up to be that person for me. So I'm very thankful for it. I mean, I don't really agree with the wars in general, but that aside, I do not regret my decision, and I would probably make the exact same decision again to go back because, you know, I met a lot of good people. I learned a lot of good things that will be with me for the rest of my life and that I'll instill in my own daughter. So, you know, I always encourage people. Actually, when I was working at InfoWars, I would have people hit me up all the time, fathers, mothers, going, hey, I've got a son or a daughter who's interested in joining the military. Could you talk to them for me? And I would listen to them and ask them questions about, you know, what they really wanted to achieve. And if I thought that they had what it takes, I would kind of encourage them to do it. And here we are, let's fast forward 15 years. The parent hit me up and said, my son, he ended up joining the Marines. He just got baptized and is married and having his first baby. And we want to thank you for getting him on that path. And he's, you know, the Marine Force taking care of him and his family and all that. So that was cool. You know, it's a great thing to have if you can be selfless and if you can work with other people. But if you're an me kind of person, it's not really going to work out too good for you.
Well said. You know, my husband is a retired FBI. He was there when it was a good FBI. And he's always said that when he was a young agent, it was the Vietnam vets who made the best agents. Those are the guys he respected. They were the leaders. They were the take charge. They were seasoned. They knew what they were doing. They made great agents. And so I kind of think that's related. I think that's kind of what you're describing. All right, so you come back home. Now, did you do your full tour of duty? Did you come back under normal circumstances, like it was just time to go, or was it because you were injured?
Yeah, it was a medical retirement. They gave you a choice. They said you can stay and you can work in supply because your injuries, I can no longer, they weren't going to allow me to do combat arms anymore. And that was the only thing I wanted to do. There's no way I could sit behind a desk and push paperwork. I would, you know, probably end up in a bad place in my head. So they said it's that or medical retirement. So I chose that and I figured I can get out and find something to do. And luckily I did.
So before we ask you what that was, you were brain injured. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
Yeah, there's a few things. I got blown up and had some shrapnel, but the main thing was I had a traumatic brain injury.
Okay.
I had two concussions back to back. I got blown up once, and then they were taking me to the hospital, and I got blown up again. So I had memory loss for a while. I still will forget where I'm at sometimes. I'll just kind of zone out. I have like chronic depression that, you know, when you've had those kind of injuries to your brain, there'll be times like I'm just sitting here and then I'll just feel mentally depressed and I don't know why. And it just, I'll have anxiety attacks and I get clammy and scared. And then, you know, I just have to learn to, you know, pray and ask God to help me or work on my breathing. I still deal with.
Yeah. I think, you know, I remember my father was in World War II and my mother, you know, they didn't talk much then, but I know he was a different man when he came back. And she would startle really easily, and a loud sound, you know, he would jump or wake up in the night. And so I think, you know, this is something that non-military people just can't quite comprehend. But it's a very real thing. And so you come back home and you did find work.
Yeah. So I get home and I'm running security for a bunch of nightclubs in Charlotte. When I first get home, because my mom had moved away from Florida. And she was up there while I was in the military back in North Carolina. So I stay with her for a little bit, and I find some jobs working for this company that own a bunch of different nightclubs. And I'm doing that for about a year. And then my friend Michael Hastings, who was a reporter for Rolling Stone and wrote a lot of books, he hits me up one night and sends me an email and going, hey, don't be surprised if the FBI contacts you. I've been working on a project like on John Brennan and things like that. And he goes, I'm going to go underground for a while. And later on that night, his car exploded in L.A. He was driving down the road and his steering wheel exploded. And they chalked it up to be an accident that he was high on drugs and wrecked his car. But I don't know how being high on drugs and wrecking your car makes your steering wheel explode. And, you know, it was very shady because, you know, I got that email from him right before that. Well, either way, fast forward to the point of how I got the job. I'm going on Fox News. I was on Megyn Kelly. I was on CNN. I was going all over the place because I sent that email out for Michael saying that, hey, I don't think this is an accident. You guys should look into this. And Alex Jones sees me on Fox and asked me to come on the show. I didn't know who he was when he called, and his producer calls back, sends me a video of Alex Jones screaming at Piers Morgan. And I go, okay, that's kind of funny. That's clever. And he goes, if you like the video, come on the show. And I was like, all right, I'll come on. So, you know, from that, a friendship sparked, and he had me come down to Austin, Texas, and then he offered me a job. He's like, I know you just got home. He goes, what about being on camera and being a reporter? And I was like, I don't know anything about that. He goes, it's good. He goes, people go to school and learn about this stuff. They usually suck. He goes, all you have to do is get in front of the camera and tell the truth about what you see. And I go, well, that sounds easy enough. And he offered me a job, and I moved to Austin, Texas.
Okay, so, all right, you worked for Alex Jones. And did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, yes, he is. All right, so intersect now. What happened that you intersected with the Proud Boys? And let me just say, look, my understanding of the Proud Boys, and then you can correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm missing something. Let me just say they're not Sunday school guys. They are men who were trying to reclaim American manhood and very resentful of the feminization of our culture. Also very angry by the riots that Antifa were sparking, the way they were harming people, Black Lives Matter as well. And so the Proud Boys would go out there anytime they had these rallies, riots. I'm not sure what to call them. And you guys were like the enforcers. You were like there to, as I understand it, you were there to protect the normal people from these bad guys.
Yes.
Because you were willing to engage with them. Okay, did I miss something about Proud Boys? Something else you'd like to add?
Yeah, so the club was originally founded by Gavin McGinnis, and it was kind of as a joke. So Gavin dealt shows. He had a podcast with some friends of his that were comedians as well. And they go and they watch this musical, Aladdin or whatever, on Broadway. And the main song is Proud of Your Boy. So he hears that. And he goes, huh, you know, he's had this idea for like a men's kind of drinking club. He goes, Proud of Your Boy, Proud Boys. He goes, oh, maybe that sounds it. So they're sitting around and, you know, on air and they're joking and, you know, they kind of come up with this, you know, idea for a club, and they call it Proud Boys based on the musical from Aladdin. I know it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, these are guys who are just joking around, being funny. So from that, the club starts, and he tells everybody, he comes up with these tenets, he comes up with the different degrees of it, and let's fast forward to Trump coming down that escalator, and he announces that he's running for president. He starts going on these, holding these rallies, and people are showing up in droves. And all of a sudden, we see this burst of, you know, Antifa, all this stuff's coming up, BLM, and they're showing up and they're assaulting people. Well, this club has been informed. It's got a bunch of alpha guys in it. And everybody collectively, we sit there, we're watching this on TV unfold in front of us, and we're going, wow, why don't we go to these events and make sure nobody gets hurt? Because we're tired of seeing, like, women being attacked, elderly, kids, all this stuff. And it just didn't make sense that no one was doing anything. The cops weren't helping them. So we decided to fill the void. So we stepped in and decided to do what everybody else is too weak to do or too scared to do or too coward to do. You know, so we started showing up, and, you know, we decided we would stand, you know, between, we'd be that buffer zone between Antifa and BLM and the peaceful people who are trying to go and listen to a new presidential candidate speak. He was well known from his shows and, you know, his career in real estate and all that. And now he's announcing that he's going to run for president, and people are curious. They want to go see what he's got to say. So, you know, people are lining up and they're being attacked, and we just didn't like that. So that's kind of how the club shifted from just being a drinking club to also being a political club. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that people could go to these rallies and feel safe. And it got to a point where we started showing up, the crowds would start cheering, and they were glad. They would come up, the families would come up and go, thank you, now we feel safe. We know we can come here without worrying about being attacked or assaulted. And somehow, you know, the left and all their glory, and what they always do is they decide to start demonizing us. They use the Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky playbook, and what used to work, you know, call us racist and all that. It just doesn't work anymore. We don't care. You can call us racist all day long. Guess what? We're still going to show up and make sure that people are safe. You know, and if we have to be the bad guy to maintain that peace, then so be it. You know, but, you know, I've read all those books. I know that they're what their playbook is. I know, you know, what they're going to do to demonize me before they do it. And I would sit down and talk with these guys and go, look, they're going to call you this. And if you let it bother you, then you're not going to be effective when we're out here on the front lines. You need to let them call you whatever, and you just sit there and bite your tongue and you hold it back and you do what we're here to do. So, you know, that's kind of what we've just had to do over the years, and just, you know, become this bad guy, this necessary bad guy. But, you know, the people who know us know that we're good people. And at the end of the day, you know what? The only opinions that matter are of, you know, what you think about yourself, what your family thinks of you and your friends. Everyone else really doesn't matter.
You know, this reminds me, you know, Curtis Lee was running for mayor of New York City. And Curtis, you know, started the Guardian Angels in New York decades ago. They wear the red berets and they would ride the subways and protect people. They you know, infiltrated the streets just to keep people from being beaten and harmed. And they were very effective. So I just think that's interesting. Of course, you've been called racist. And I think I always thought that was pretty funny, since Enrico Tarrio ended up being your leader, and he was at least on January the 6th, and he's a black Cuban, is he not? Isn't he a black Cuban?
He's Cuban.
Yeah, so not exactly, doesn't exactly fit the profile of racist, but anyway,
but what is racist, though? Anybody can be racist. That's the thing that people have changed over the years, the leftist thing. And, you know, they say that only white people can be racist, but there can be racist Cubans, racist blacks, racist Asians. At some point in time, someone's going to say something that can be considered racist. And it's like I said, at the end of the day, that term's been so watered down that it really just holds no meaning anymore.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with you, with your definition and with your conclusion. I totally agree with you. So anyway, so take us back now to January the 6th. And actually, I know you've discussed this ad nauseum in the last several years, but I'm kind of interested to see what your experience was like. I would ask you this. Were the Proud Boys, did you guys go to the Capitol to hear President Trump speak before that because you wanted to violently overthrow the government Was that your plan? Were you armed and ready to do an insurrection?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is what the prosecutor said at my sentencing, that I was the commanding general on the battlefield, and that I was a military tactician, a genius when it comes to, you know, things military. So let's just take that, and now let's go back to that day. All right, if I'm this military tactician, genius, this commanding general on the battlefield, why didn't I tell my soldiers to bring guns? Why did I tell them not to bring weapons? And why did I tell them not to dress up as if to look like they were going into combat? I told them to dress in regular attire, to not bring any weapons. I mean, obviously, you always get like one in the group that will show up and, you know, try to be different and bring a stick or something. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was about it. There was one guy who brought like a handle or something, an axe handle. And there's no way I can see in that many people who's got something or not. No, I mean, it was the FBI has all of our chats. They had all of our video communications, and not once did we ever talk about overthrowing the Capitol, stopping the certification, the election. Those terms were never even used. We never even mentioned anything like that. All we did was talk about the stabbing that had happened. BLM had stabbed four of our guys on December 20th prior to the January 6th rally, and our concern was that if we did go back to this rally that Trump called people to, that something like that could happen again. So we wanted to make sure that our security was tighter and better, and that if we did have any armor, that it was stab-proof and it would be worn under our clothing so as not to draw attention. And that's the only thing you could ever find in any of our communications, was our concern for the safety of our guys, because if something happens to one of my guys and I'm in charge, well, that's going to haunt me for the rest of my life, because I care about people. I mean, that's the reason I'm putting my life on the line, to go out there to make sure that, you know, the civilian population stays safe, because the cops are too scared to go out there and do their job, because they are more concerned with playing left-wing politics than they are doing their job, which is, you know, keeping the peace.
Well, I lived in D.C. for a long time. I had moved before January the 6th, but we went to there was a huge rally in September right before the election, and my husband and I went. There were so many people there. It was amazing. But Antifa did show up. You know, my husband, as I said, former FBI, and we were concerned that I can't remember if he carried his gun or not. I honestly can't remember that. But we were very concerned about safety. Nevertheless, we went because that was their habit. They were attacking people, and they actually attacked people at the inauguration. They attacked people just attending the inauguration. They were horrid people. And so all of us were concerned that on January 6th, Antifa would show up. And mysteriously, well, we know now that there were some there, but for outwardly, they did not show up. Were you surprised, and did you see something that I missed? Did you see some Antifa there that I might have missed?
Yeah, there was one guy, Don Sullivan. He was right there beside Ashley Babbitt filming when she was shot.
Right.
That guy is a well-known Antifa guy, and his brother, who's a Trump supporter, even called him out and said, yeah, he's Antifa. They were in the crowd. I mean, they were blending in. I mean, I think they knew that it was going to be a large turnout, and it wouldn't be, you know, those people live there, and they know the kind of crowds that are drawn for certain things. I think everybody knew, with the fact that most people were angry, that they felt the election was stolen, and we do know that the election was stolen now for sure, that people were going to show up and be pissed off. So I don't think they had the, you know, the cojones to really show up in force dressed up in all black, because I think they probably knew they'd get beat down pretty badly if they were to do that. So, or now that we know that, you know, even Nancy Pelosi has said that, you know, this was her doing, coming from her own mouth, they probably had some inside knowledge to stay away that day.
I believe
270 FBI agents.
274. 274.
They don't have that many to work at that office. So for them to just go, oh, we just happened to call them up. No, you don't have that many agents there. They knew in advance, and they were there for a reason.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you, Joe. And they were mysteriously missing, at least overtly. And yes, there were Antifa in the crowd, but there were a few others too, breaking out windows and all that. Just the typical Antifa breaking out windows, using the same methods we'd seen them before in other riots. So, but I agree with your analysis completely, and I do suspect that the FBI was coordinating with them. I truly do. So they were not there. So, okay, we've talked kind of the 100-degree angle where we're looking down, but what was your experience like? What did you see? What did you see as you entered the grounds, and what unfolded?
So we all met at 10 a.m. at the Washington Monument, just away from the ellipse where Trump was holding his rally. And we marched towards the Capitol while that was going on because there were other rallies that we wanted to check on. Enrique and I were supposed to speak at a Latinas for Trump event as well. And so we wanted to start marching down the mall and kind of get a feel for the area because we knew as his rally ended, people were going to march around towards the Capitol. And we wanted to get eyes on to see if we saw Antifa anywhere or anything like that. So we start marching down that way. We've got live streamers. We've got camera crews, documentary filmmakers. These aren't the actions of people who are going to carry out an attack on the Capitol. Why would we build that and incriminate ourselves? I mean, if I'm this genius, I'm doing pretty stupid stuff so far as a general on the ground. I'm filming that I'm about to break a crime commit a crime, and then I'm telling my guys not to bring weapons. So I'm already not a genius. The Proud Boys can barely get a Taco Bell order right without starting a fight with each other. So much less coordinate, an attack on the Capitol, which is one of the most well-guarded buildings in the country, with an unknown amount of people on the inside with weapons stashed all over the place. Yeah, that's a great idea. So we start marching towards the Capitol. We go around to the other side where SCOTUS is, and there's another event over there. We take a break, and the crowd disperses. We meet with all the people because they always like to talk to us and, say, hey, thanks for making us feel safe. And then after that, we marched around, got in front of the Capitol, and took the famous picture that everybody sees on the news like every other day when they talk about it, where it shows me in the front like making a growl face. But it's the same face I make for anything. My daughter makes that face in her pictures. I made that same face when I go to SHOT Show or if I go to a football game. But they were like, oh, look at him. He's getting amped up for the storming of the Capitol. And I'm like, yeah, that's not even a thought in anybody's head at that time. It wasn't until, Ray Epps told everybody to break down that fence that we even start to notice that things were kind of different and something was off.
I don't know if you know this, Joe, but the whole report on Ray Epps is going to be released very soon here. This is what I'm hearing. And we're going to actually know what the truth is about him. Enrico Terrio, you're the leader of Proud Boys, on January the 6th, was arrested on his airplane. Before he even got off the plane, he was arrested, which is weird to me. But how did that affect you guys?
No, he landed and got into a cab, and he was going to his hotel. And there's one of the tunnels that you have to go through when you're going into D.C. I can't remember the tunnel it is.
It's like the 395.
You go under a bridge, and it's like park.
Yes.
And they surrounded his car with vehicles and pulled out guns and ran up to him in the Uber and arrested him because he had a magazine on him, an empty AR magazine that he had engraved at his shop because he does laser engravings and makes T-shirts and all that. And a guy had bought one. And he was going to be in D.C. that day, so he was just going to hand deliver the guy the empty magazine and give it to him to take home. And they used that as a preface to detain him and arrest him. And what they did is that the judge ordered his removal from D.C., and he was forced to go to Baltimore and stay in a hotel there while we were there on January 6th. So it was Ethan Ordine and I who were kind of like, on the ground in charge that day.
I didn't know that. I'd never heard that about his arrest. It was always presented like they apprehended him at the airport. So that's very interesting. And how did they know? How did they know all that? So anyway, I guess they hadn't felt. My understanding
we've been under surveillance for a long time.
Yeah, my understanding
illegally.
Was a couple.
They use FISA courts to go after us. They've been spying on us through the FISA courts for a long time.
Okay. Yep, I know all about my husband was the agent that presented evidence to the FISA court during the Iraq War. So we know how that's supposed to work, not the way it worked on January the 6th. So you, when did things go badly? Ray Epps is shouting to retake the the barrier away, is that when you guys entered the Capitol?
Oh, well, that was come sometime later. But, yeah, so we take the picture, and at 2 o'clock that afternoon, you know, I think it was like around, I can't remember what time it was. It was like noonish or something like that, and we're heading back. And we had the Misfits, the old punk band, the lead singer for the Misfits. He was going to be playing an acoustic set at our Airbnb. So we wanted to be back by 2 o'clock. We're leaving. We go to the food trucks right there by the federal courthouse, and we're sitting there. And on the radio, we can hear Trump tell everybody to head to the Capitol. So we're sitting there eating at the food trucks, and as we look across to the mall, the federal court behind us, the grass in front of us, we see sea of people moving, and we go, oh, man, let's go see what's going on. Because we don't know what's really happening. We just heard Trump tell everybody to go to the Capitol. So we make a left and go to the Peace Circle, and as we get there, we see a huge crowd of people. And someone hands me the bullhorn, and we start doing, like, you know, F Antifa chants and stuff like that and Proud Boys stuff. And that's it. We're marching up to the crowd, and we're sitting there having a conversation. We're just kind of watching to see what's going on. Everybody's standing here. And next thing you know, we hear there's a guy with a black megaphone, and he's dressed all in black, and he's going, we need women to get away from the front. We need military men to the front. Get the women. And they're talking about you break the fence down and all that stuff. Well, this guy, when he gets caught and arrested or whatever, he's seen by the same judge as me, Judge Timothy Kelly. So it's known, he tells this guy that you started the whole riot, but then he tells me that I started the riot too. Like, how can both these things be true? Like, they lied so much. But the guy in the black with the megaphone, he was telling everybody how to disarm this stuff. This guy was with Ray Epps. Ray Epps was in there.
Really?
All these guys with, like, little earbuds in, and they're commanding and telling people what to do.
Wow.
And they go up to the fence, and we can't see it because we're so far back. So I know this in hindsight, but at the time, we're just sitting there talking. The Capitol's to my back, and I'm looking towards the Washington Monument. And then all the Proud Boys are standing in front of me. They're looking at the Capitol. I'm just sitting there, like, we're joking, laughing. And the next thing you know, everybody starts surging forward. And Ethan Ordine puts up his fist. He's going, whoa, 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 everybody stop. But by then, we don't know that the fence had just been knocked down, that there was a scuffle, and everybody's pushing forward. It's like a sea of people. It's like a current. You couldn't get away from it. You just had to move with it. So as we're pushing forward, we're stepping over the fence, and I look at everybody and go, oh, crap, this isn't good. And then we just start pushing forward. And then we get up to the next fence, which is, there's this stage there for the inauguration. Well, at this point in time, everybody gets up to the stage and everything's peaceful. People are waving flags. And I guess that Trump had said something like, hey, I might go up there and speak or something. So a lot of people, I guess, they're thinking that they're trying to get up there to get a close spot to see him. You know, so we're sitting there and the fence starts to come down to my right. Well, after watching the footage, it goes down again right where Ray Epps is, and then he conveniently walks away after he creates the chaos.
Wow.
The fence goes down to, he's in the center of where that fence is. It goes down like dominoes to the left and to the right, and it just starts going down. Well, conveniently for my trial, they glitch out where it goes in front of him and only unglitch it when it goes down right in front of me. And go, look, Joe Biggs knocked it down. He's the one who destroyed the fence. So they get me with the destruction of government property. Because we actually saw the whole footage. The entire trial was a kangaroo court. The judge is corrupt. He's a liar. And I'll say that. I don't care. He could get butthurt about it all he wants. But the prosecutors have already been fired. Judge Timothy Kelly should be fired, impeached. But I've never seen something so dishonest in my entire life. You know, we couldn't even bring in exculpatory evidence. There were so many Brady violations. But, you know, this fence goes down, and it's not my doing, and I get blamed for it. And then at this point in time, after the fence goes down, there's still no violence. People are just waving the flags. Well, all of a sudden, somebody on the cop side, they come up, they do a rotation with their hand, and the snipers come up with the non-lethal rounds and start firing into the crowd. One guy has a round, he goes through his cheek, there's blood everywhere, it's squirting on the ground, people are slipping in blood. And then one of the police officers in riot gear punches a lady, 45 years old, and knocks her out. Well, I see that, and it pisses them off. So they start running up to the cop and getting in his face, and that's when the whole riot. It has nothing to do with the certification of the election. It had to do with the fact that the cops decided to fire into the crowd. They started shooting flashbangs, smoke grenades. One guy had a heart attack and died from it. you know, there was a lot of messed up stuff that happened that day. You know, we forced the FBI and the Capitol Police to acknowledge that nobody was killed that day. The protesters, there were no police that were killed that day. That was all a big lie that they still tell on TV. And the fact that they can get away with that, I don't still don't understand.
Yeah. But well, let me just
their
say,
their job is to maintain peace, and they didn't do it. They started a war.
Yeah, I've had multiple people say the same thing on this microphone on this show. Plus, I've seen tons of video. Now we've seen like the just there's great video now that's been finally released, you know. And you guys, I will affirm what you just said. They would not let you guys use even the video that you had in your defense. It was a kangaroo court. Every court was a kangaroo court. Let me also add that Ray Epps was that great big guy. We've discussed it before, but some may not remember. He was first seen, I think, a day before. He's downtown D.C. with a bullhorn telling people, tomorrow we'll go to the Capitol. And people around him say, no, we're not. No, we can't do that. Basically something like that. Then he's flashed forward to the next day. He is the one standing by the fence, whispering in someone's ear, who then goes over and pushes the fence over. So Ray Epps is a suspicious character who finally the FBI had to arrest because there was so much pressure on them. But it's just been very murky who he really is. And again, I would say the real story about Ray Epps is coming out very soon. I've been told that any day now we're going to know exactly, and that might help you, not that you're on trial anymore, thank God, but Joe, your judge was Judge Kelly?
Yes.
Yeah, the judges were horrible, and they should all be impeached. I'm with you, totally. So you go back home, I'm sure, to whatever you were doing, having no idea that, you know, you're going to have this future that you had. When were you arrested? What was the circumstance?
I was arrested on January 20th, the day Biden took office, right after he swore in. The FBI came and got me. I was in a federal courthouse in Orlando, Florida, being arraigned shortly after his inauguration.
And at that time, were you married, Joe? I know you have a daughter.
No.
But you have a daughter.
Yes. She lives with me, Savannah.
Okay, Savannah. So you had this trial. You're sentenced to 17 years, and that is, I think, the second highest. I think Stuart Rhodes got 1 year more than you. He's the head of Oath Keepers. I want to ask you something, because I know that during the trial, many of the defendants were asked to recant what they believed. They were asked to sign statements that they no longer believed the presidential election was stolen, and they demanded that of even, I remember, a young boy and his family, all required to sign these statements to lie, actually. And that is just not done in American U.S. courts of law. You can be convicted for what you did do, but you are not forced to recant anything that you did. I mean, you might in court apologize. Okay, I'm going on and on here, Joe. But did you feel like you were being pressured to say things you didn't mean?
I told the day that I got arrested and I got a lawyer, I told my lawyer this. I said, I know that they're going to come down on me hard because of who I am. I said, if they offer you a plea, I said, tell them to go get lost. I said, if they tell me that they need me to make up a story about someone, I tell them to go jump off a bridge. I said, if they ever come to you and ask me for anything, I said, you tell them to go get lost. And so my lawyer told them immediately, don't come to us for anything. So they never came to me with a plea. They never came to me with anything because I refused to say I did something I didn't do. I'm not going to plea out to something I know I didn't do. And if I had to go to jail for the rest of my life to stay honest and hold true to my integrity, you know, my mother supported that idea, and you know, I knew my family was staying behind me because I was going to stand on principle. I'm not going to lie to myself, and I'm not going to say that I did something I didn't do. So I was willing to die for that, and I still am.
Your attorney was Norman Patter, is that right? P-A-T-T-E-R.
At the beginning it was Dan Hull, and then it was Norm Pattis.
Pattis. Okay. I want to play a statement he made after your conviction and ask you about it. This is clip 7. Let's listen.
Afterwards, the men's lawyers said both had been influenced by the lies of Donald Trump.
As Judge Kelly noted in the REL sentencing, it's a mitigating factor, but not a justifying or excusing factor. But, you know, if your president tells you your country's been stolen, the country that people fought and died for, people are trying to take your vote from you, How are you supposed to react to that? And these people reacted violently and to their detriment.
The longest jail term handed out to anyone involved in what happened in Capitol Hill remains the one given to the leader of the right-wing self-styled militia, the Oath Keepers. Stuart Rhodes was jailed for 18 years. Both Biggs and Rail were close allies of the Proud Boys chairman, Enrique Tarrio. He has been convicted and will be sentenced on Tuesday.
All right, my main emphasis is to play what Patter said, and that, look, I know a defense lawyer has to defend you, and I understand how that works, but that's pretty, I found myself wondering if he wasn't assigned to you. Did you choose him?
Yeah, I chose him. I don't know what he said that day. This is the first time I've ever heard, so I have no idea. I mean, he's probably just playing it safe for an interview that just happened right after that. Who knows? I don't really care. Whatever's done is done. But trust me, he was way better than the other one.
Really? Okay. Well, I know that was a problem.
Oh, yeah, the other one was constantly cussing people out. He attacked every person that I had that was going to come speak for me at trial. And, you know, the guy was a nightmare. He was a loose cannon, and it was one of the worst things I ever had to deal with after dealing with what I was going through at the time. And actually what they wanted to do is when I was being sentenced, when Judge Kelly said 17 years, the prosecution jumped up and pitched a fit. They go, we wanted 36.
They wanted 36 years. Yes, they did. Yes, because you guys planned the whole thing, right? So, Joe, just a few more questions for you. You spent 4 years then in prison. Is that right?
Yep, and 2 years of that was in solitary confinement, sitting in a concrete room by myself.
Were you in the D.C. jail?
I went to all kinds of jails. It's called diesel therapy. They do that to people they don't like, people they want to break and try to make an example out of, but I'm too strong for them.
Well, I do know about this, too, and we've discussed this with a lot of guys that were in the D.C. gulag. But so you were there for a bit of time?
Yeah, that was the nicest jail I ever went to. Out of all the places I went to, that was the nicest one I ever went to.
Now, that's interesting.
I felt like I was at a Ritz-Carlton.
All right. Well, I'll have to put you on with a couple of the guys that were there that might not agree with you about that. But they
only stayed there, though. You got to understand, those guys had it made because they were surrounded by like-minded people. They didn't have to go around gang members like I did and have to worry about being stabbed and killed all the time and be poisoned with fentanyl. They just had to sit around the same people all the time and the same thing. I mean, I think they had it the easiest and the nicest, and I wish I could have been in the D.C. jail the entire time. I would have been in heaven.
Interesting. Okay, interesting perspective. That perspective I've not heard. But, all right, so President Trump, then, the day he was inaugurated, Bruce and I were in D.C. for the inauguration, and we watched on television and just were beside ourselves with joy as he pardoned so many of the J6ers. But you and I think 14, something like that, others, did not receive full pardons. You only had your sentence commuted. And so tell us,
it was originally a pardon that day. And then they came back and they go, no, they've changed their mind. So someone went to Trump, and I'm not going to say who, but one of two people went to Trump and decided to step in and screw us over. I don't think it was Trump personally at all. I really don't think that that's something that he would have done. But I do believe it's someone very close to him, his gatekeeper, who decided to make that decision. And now we're struggling and fighting every day to get our life back. And it's just, it's insane that I still have to deal with this. It's like I'm out of jail, but I'm still a prisoner because, you know, now it's actually even kind of worse because, you know, I can't get a job. I can't go to my daughter's school. I can't take her on a field trip because I am a domestic terrorist with like 13 felonies. I'm a seditious conspirator, you know, and with that being said, you know, the amount of money that had to be sent to me monthly to get commissary is nowhere the amount of money it costs for me to live here now in the open. So I feel like a drain on the family. It's just, it sucks. And here I am. I fought for my country. And when my country asked again, I fought for him again. And, you know, I just don't like being treated the way that I am. And it's just, I'm kind of fed up with it.
So you've lost your pension, you've lost your medical care, and you don't have any income. How old is Savannah? Joe?
She's 8.
She's 8 years old. And she,
yeah, when I left her, she was 3. I turned 4 2 days later, and I asked the judge to let me stay a few more days before they put me in jail so I could be there for her 4th birthday, and he just laughed and said no.
Well, it's
lovely.
So I saw
my daughter one time for 15 minutes in 4 years.
It is absolutely horrendous, unforgivable, what the government did, what the Biden administration did to you guys. So I think what I need to know now is, Joe, how can people help you? How can they help you? Is there a website, something that you would refer them to so they could make a donation to help you in the interim, which I'm praying that you're going to be fully pardoned. That's what I'm working toward, and I am working toward that. So in the interim, you need to have money, as you've well explained, and we all understand that. So if people would like to help you, how could they do that?
Well, I have a GiveSendGo that a friend of mine put up for me. It's GiveSendGo.com/Joe Biggs. And it'll say that it was set up by Pete Santilli. If you guys see that one, it should have some money already on there a little bit. And I've had that up for a while. I've been, you know, being able to use that here and there to help get by. But still nowhere near enough. You know, I don't know how long this is going to take until I get my rights back. And, you know, I'm medically retired, so, you know, I was at 100%. So, I mean, just that alone, if I get that back, that pardon alone is going to save me, you know, in a sense, and not make me feel like I'm drowning every day.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
and you know, I shouldn't be in this position.
No, but you listen, you know, the other J6ers are in a similar position. I know some of them have landed on their feet, but not that many. They can't find jobs. There's a taint, you know, like they have cooties, and people won't hire them, and they're struggling. You know, there have been a lot of, I don't need to tell you, suicides. I understand that some of them have actually just disappeared, just gone off the grid. And we don't want that to happen with you. You're very vocal about what's happening, and I think that's healthy, actually. And so let me repeat that address, because I want to make sure I got it right. It's givesendgo.com/GoBiggs, G-O-B-I-G-G-S.
Joe.
Oh,
J-O-B,
Joe.
Joe Biggs.
Oh, see, I'm glad I asked. Okay, givesendgo.com/Joe Biggs. And I would encourage each and every one of you, even if you can not afford very much something, you know, we can multiply that if we all give him something. And even if he just gets a short-term relief or some encouragement from all of us to let him know that people actually do care about him and his daughter, Savannah.
You can follow me, too, on X at Real Rambo Biggs. It's Real Rambo Biggs. My old Twitter account, I had 500,000 followers on it, and they took that. You know, the FBI, you know, I lost my house, my truck. I lost... They took all my clothes. Like, why does the FBI need my clothes? They took everything out of my house, every piece of electronic equipment, an Xbox that was a Christmas gift that was going to be, was still in the box. It had never been opened. They took that. Basically, they just robbed to be blind. And, you know, so you can follow me on X at Real Rambo Biggs, R-E-A-L, Rambo Biggs, B-I-G-G-S. And, yeah. And you can learn, you know, updates as things happen, if they do.
Okay, this is really a personal question, and it is the last one I'll ask you, Joe. You mentioned that you had faith. You've talked about God a little bit. Are you in a good place with God, or are you angry, or what's your honest position on that right now? You know, your friend Patrick is an atheist. He's very honest with me about that. So I'm asking you an honest question.
Oh, I'm a sinner, and I make a lot of mistakes, and I'm constantly asking God for forgiveness. But, you know, when I was in prison, I needed a sign from God that things were going to be okay, that he was in control. And, you know, they kept feeding us the same stuff every day. And this is when I was in Alexandria at the where they keep all the terrorists and stuff like that. And I was there with the Lockerbie bomber and some ISIS guys and some MS-13 hitman and pedophiles and rapists and things like that. I mean, they were the worst. We kept getting like these rotten apples, and I was like, God, I was like, just give me a sign. I was like, let me get peaches tomorrow. And I asked the officer, the CEO, I was like, man, you guys ever get peaches? He laughed at me. He was like, we never have peaches here. I've worked here 25 years. Well, the next day, he knocks on the door and hands me my food tray. And he goes, I don't know what you did, man. He goes, but there's peaches on your tray. And I go, what? And I just fell down to the ground and started crying. And I prayed and I said, God, right, I know I'm good. And that was it. Like, after that, I learned to find joy in there. I knew God was in control. And, you know, I was just going to let him deal with this. And I was just going to sit back and let him take, you know, the reins on that. So it saved me right there.
Well, that's great. I mean, it is great because only God can heal your wounds. And only God can really even deliver you. And so we're going to pray to that end, Joe. And that helps people to understand how to pray about you, to pray for you also. So it's givesandgo.com/Joe Biggs and at Real Rambo Biggs on X if you want to follow him. Joe, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for giving us just your story. It's a treasure, and we will be, you let me know. If you get a call and you get your sentence pardoned, you be sure and let me know. We're going to shout it from the housetops, okay?
All right, we'll do it.
Okay, all right. Well, God bless you, Joe. And this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Reborn has a passion for saving unborn babies from abortion and seeing women come to Christ. Over the past 18 years, Preborn clinics have counseled over 500,000 women considering abortion, and more than 300,000 babies have been saved, and over 80,000 women have come to Christ. Now that's real life. You know, that's eternal life. That's what we want for their babies too, eventually. Every day, Preborn Network Clinics rescues 200 babies from abortion. If you would like to join our effort to stop abortion, that's really what they're doing. That's what I'm doing, too. It's a mutually agreed upon mission. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Well, there's a new January the 6th committee, and of course the first one was a complete sham. It was like a mini-series on television, scripted by a Hollywood producer. You can't make these things up. And it was a disgrace, and it smeared so many fine people. Well, the vile hatred still exists against anybody who tries to say something different about January the 6th, or who makes the case that the election was stolen of 2020. So there's a price to be paid for taking a stand. And one person that's taking a stand is Congressman Barry Loudermilk from Georgia. I've interviewed Congressman Loudermilk when he first formed the first J6 committee. Now he's back, and there is a J6 committee, and they're doing really fine work, and they're exposing a lot of things that we have not heard before. I think they're the ones that are going to be coming out with that Ray Epps report that I referenced when we were talking to Joe. But I want to give you an idea because I think it's important. We forget how great a price our congressmen are paying for what they really believe. And in the case of Barry Loudermilk, there is a montage of the phone threats he's had to him and his family. And I want you to hear it because I want you to be moved to pray and remember them and appreciate their courage. Here it is, clip 4.
I hope you get dragged in front of a military tribunal. I hope you get a Marine firing squad. It's too good for you. That'd be too good for you, you. I hope you die a billion mother deaths in hell, you big mother.
Obviously, I think I like the 9/11 attackers better than I like you, you traitor, because I want to see you with a shank and twisted shank in your throat, okay? You f***ing traitor, mother f***.
Oh, and the b- who answers your phone? You deserve to be beaten just like Gaddafi was. You deserve to be dragged out onto the street and beaten until you're a bloody mess.
You are a f***ing traitor and should put a 45 in your mouth and pull the trigger and blow your treasonous brains out, you son of a.
I think he's a traitor. He better beef up his security.
piece of garbage. You, family, and my boot when they scumbag. But my boot will be up when you're no longer protected by whatever the protects a piece of like you, scumbag. If I don't get you, I'll get your friends and let them know I'm on my way to you, you piece of subhuman.
Wow. You know, I used to get email like that. We didn't have, and messages like that. I remember when after Bruce and I got married, I shared some of them with him. Some so vile, I just, of course, I deleted them. I didn't exactly spend time looking at them. Things that they wished my daughter, just horrific things. You know, this is just really from the pit of hell. And I'd like to make the point that what decent, good man or woman would volunteer to run for Congress and put up with that kind of abuse? I'd say it's only really, really good men who are willing to do that. And we have a lot of them in Congress, and yet we are filled, and I am. I'm one of the biggest critics because I am. I criticize them often. But I think we need to praise them more often and encourage them. Otherwise, I think we will empty the Congress of the good men. I really do. If they don't have our support and they're receiving this kind of treatment, can you imagine? The Democrats don't have to worry about this. And neither do the Republican rhinos. It's the really good men who actually, and women, who want to do what's right, who get this kind of abuse. It is from the pit of hell. It's spreading like poison throughout our country. And so we just need to be vigilant and certainly pray. And I would invite you, please, to pray for Joe Biggs. Just pray for him, that God would just continue to be present in his life, in the life of his daughter, and also that God would redeem his circumstances, like Job, to restore the years the locusts have eaten. That'll be my prayer for him, and I hope you'll join me in that. Well, I hope you benefited from today's show, and I always appreciate you listening. What would we do without you? Please tell your friends about the show if you enjoy it. It's a good way of getting the truth out there because that's what we're pledged to tell. And that's, hopefully, what we brought you today on this edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.